Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This is just one segment of today's show. You can hear all of our conversations about New York's vibrant cultural scene on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We're at 93.9 on FM. We're online at WNYC.org. And occasionally, we're on the streets. Like now, as we have traveled to the East Village home of the Blue Man Group. Now, no one's really been able to pin down what this performance group actually is. But Time magazine came close, calling them, quote, a potpourri of physical stunts, visual gags, art commentary, audience participation, and all-out sensory assault. Not bad, but what they left out was the musical component. Here in the Blue Man Group rehearsal space / recording studio, the musical side is very much in evidence as this large black room is littered with drums and lengths of the PVC pipes that the troupe has used in its shows for over 15 years. The founders of Blue Man Group are Phil Stanton, Matt Goldman, who'll be joining us momentarily, and Chris Wink, who joins me now. Chris, welcome.
Hello, thanks.
Or thank you for welcoming us,
yes,
as the case
welcome
may be.
Welcome to the big black box that we do our experiments in.
Now, is this space the original space that Blue Man Group started in?
No. The original space was our living room. We were roommates, and we just threw away all the furniture. That was several years of really just doing it as a labor of love. Mm-hmm. In all of our free time, we all had to work in jobs, and we didn't have a big master plan of where it would go. And so everything happened in our house, and it became kind of an obsession. And we built everything ourselves and just cleared away everything in the house except for space and tools to make drums and other things like that.
So we're talking about like 1987, thereabouts?
Yeah, well, it really, a little later in a sense, because the first thing we did was just get blue and go out and do a couple of happenings, like the funeral for the 80s, and we used to go out to clubs that had velvet ropes and people waiting to get in. We would velvet rope, cordon off a section of sidewalk and offer an alternative that had an open door policy to all people. I guess it was more like 88, 89 that we went indoors and started to develop, you know, some of our things. Mm. You know, at first we were just sort of walking around, and then we started building things. And we really didn't set out to become instrument inventors. We really only started building things like PVC pipes because we just couldn't find an instrument that suited our needs.
Well, before I get to what those needs might have been, how much of what you guys did back then was a result of just whatever artistic ferment was going on here in the East Village at that time?
Well, you know, part of our feeling was more in reaction to what was happening. We didn't feel a part of anything. Couldn't find a way in to any movement that resonated for us. The work at the time, of course, there was various camps, but some of it was very kind of glamour star-oriented. The various protégés of Andy Warhol, you know, in the 80s were all dancing at Studio 54 and being very glamorous. There was a super intellectual strand of performance, mm-hmm, that was coming out of grad schools and the Whitney program and so on. And then there was sort of the leftovers of experimental theater from the 70s that was still kicking around but was just sort of, you know, losing a lot of its interest, at least to us. And so a lot of also performance art that was just a monologue. It was really just a person talking about their life, and it was called performance art, and we didn't quite know why that was necessarily performance art. And so we also were interested in music, but the musical, you know, the late 80s was not, you know, a golden era of musical innovation either. So there was just this sense that we couldn't fall in line with some movement. We had to just sort of amuse ourselves any way we could without really, and we really turned away from this neighborhood and looked more around the world for inspiration. We looked to the Japanese Buto dancers and Kodo drummers. I had studied a little West African drumming and West African dance at Wesleyan. They had a great ethnomusicology department and exposed me a little bit to, and as a drummer, I was interested in some of the percussion from around the world, jazz and, of course, you know, punk rock and rock and roll and stuff like that. So we started looking not only around the world for inspiration, but also back all the way a century and a half, and then finally to what we would imagine it would have been like in Paleolithic, you know, caves of Lascaux 25,000 years ago, because essentially as we walked around the city, we felt a kind of coldness, a kind of aloofness, insularity, and we wanted to give voice to that, our feeling of what was missing for us. And so it caused us instinctively to yearn for kind of a tribal primal vibe. And that's the connection between modern rock and roll and sort of this more tribal primitive, as we imagine it in our heads, music.
So, Chris, it sounds like, you know, a lot of the stuff that was coming out of the East Village at that time was being termed avant-garde art of some stripe or another. And from what you're saying, it sounds like you guys were not attempting to be in any way, shape, or form avant-garde.
Well, especially because the work that we were aware of that was attempting specifically to be avant-garde was the stuff we hated the most. there's a self-consciousness if you're trying to be avant-garde. I suspect that when the Dadaists were doing their crazy stuff in the 20s and 30s and the Surrealists, somehow they weren't trying to be avant-garde. They just were expressing their feelings perhaps about World War One or the craziness of the modern era, and others termed them avant-garde. It becomes a problem when you go to grad school and it becomes a career path to try to become avant-garde, and there's a kind of a pretension that can come about it.
It's sort of like being cool, right?
You can't
set out to be cool. You can't, if once you try to be cool, you are not cool.
I think that's what it was, and I think at a certain point we we're here in the East Village, and we said, you know what, we're not going to try to be cool, and we're not even going to try to be part of this whole scene, and we're just going to do our thing.
All right, and your thing involved catching stuff in your mouth and womping on lengths of PVC pipe. Now, while you were talking, Chris Wink, Matt Goldman has joined us, another of the founders of the Blue Man Group. Matt, Chris was talking about how pretty early on in the game you guys started working with these lengths of PVC piping that are all over this space here, because it kind of suited the needs of the group. What were those needs that PVC pipes filled?
Yeah, there was a need that only PVC pipe could fill.
Well, we had tried, you know, xylophones.
Yeah.
Because those, in theory, would have satisfied one of the needs, right, which was to make music with percussion, because we were all kind of more percussionists.
The real issue we had at that moment was we were doing a lot of stuff with drums, and we were building our own drums and making pieces and songs with drums, but we had a real desire to have melody and to have something that was a little more beautiful and something that the dynamic range could go real, real soft. And we also, even though we were huge fans of punk and that really was a tremendous influence on us, we liked harmonies and catchy kind of hooks, really. And so the only way you can do that is if you have a whole array of notes. And so the very first PVC instrument allowed us to do that. It gave us, I don't remember the exact number of notes, but 30 or 40 notes. And of course we were writing our first song the moments before our first gig, because it took us all the way to that night at midnight gluing all the pipes together just to get the notes. So the first song was written very quickly behind the curtain.
But we had gone to the store and picked up a couple of different things in the xylophone family, whether you're talking about, you know, a glockenspiel or some of these wooden things from World Instrument stores and everything. And we thought, you know, well, this could be the answer. And we played every one of them, and, you know, we really tried. And the thing that we still can't understand for today, for some reason, that whole family of instruments suck. I don't know why.
No,
it's just the way they sound.
To us.
They suck. I mean, tell me one good song using one of those instruments.
I can name any number of Steve Reich pieces.
Okay, well, there you go. But that's what I'm. No. But
you're talking about a song.
You know, I'm being kidding. I'm kidding.
I mean,
for us, the sort of soft mallet version of the instruments is too mellow. Mm. It just has that sort of Muzak that's been made out of
that.
Let me interrupt you here.
Okay. Let's go over to the instruments. Tell me what you're talking about. Okay. What it is that makes these PVC things, over the course now of, what, 18 years, such an enduring part of the legacy that is Blue Man Group. And once again, I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck. We're on location with Chris Wink and Matt Goldman, two of the founding members of Blue Man Group, in their performance space, rehearsal studio. This is where you guys record, too, right?
Absolutely.
All right, so...
Well, there's two things that we should talk about. One is the xylophones, as we said, in that family. Right. We all know what we kind of mean, those sort of slabs of metal or wood that you hit. If you hit it with a soft mallet, it has that, you know, Muzak vibe, or the worst kind of jazz fusion or whatever.
Baja marimba band kind of thing.
Well, no, marimba band, I think of steel drums, which is a different vibe necessarily. Okay. But I know what you mean. But still, that's something we weren't attracted to. Now, if you hit it with a hard mallet, you get that metallic sound.
Right.
And what's interesting about that is that what makes it unique, if you listen carefully, is the overtone is really loud.
Mm-hmm.
What makes it sound metal is that there's a basic tone, and there's another tone lurking behind it. It's kind of out of tune with it, and it gives it that little clank.
Right.
And we were somehow instinctively repelled by that overtone. As far as we can tell, and we haven't had a physicist check this, the tubes are a pure note without an overtone. And you probably know more about music than that, so you can tell us here today whether we're crazy or not. Now,
I think I can tell you that before I hear a note. But
okay. All right. Well, I'll just keep going. And the other thing that we liked about the PVC, obviously, is that it's kind of quirky. It's an industrial trapping, a throwaway item. It's something you don't not necessarily throw away, but you take for granted. It's in the pipes all around us. We love that element of the PVC. And in terms of the sound, there's a nice attack.
Mm-hmm.
But has a deep resonant tone, especially if you go to the low notes. And it almost alludes ever so slightly to kind of a spaghetti Western guitar. It's a little more pizzicata, obviously, than a guitar could be. But so I'll show you what I mean. If you go down low, we'll start down here. This one's so low you can actually hear... You can almost hear the sound waves go up and down, you know, the beats, as you would say.
This is
and you can't do that on a xylophone.
The lowest note that you can, anything lower than this doesn't really...
Doesn't come through. And this is about close to the higher range. You can go a little higher than that, but you can see you start to lose your sustain.
Right.
Not that you have much sustain to begin with. We put them together in rows that were not chromatic, but were suited for... someone who's used to playing a drum kit. These four notes are placed the same way a snare, a floor tom, and two toms would be played. And so I'm going to play a drum beat that I learned when I was a kid on a drum kit. That's just a drummer with notes arranged completely... to suit our needs as opposed to if those notes were spread across here chromatically, I actually wouldn't be able to do that.
Okay, so instead of going from low notes to high notes, they're scattered so that when you play the pattern, you get the notes that you
see,
want.
See, the assumption that a regular chromatic instrument makes is that you're going to practice and have skill. This instrument is based on the idea that you have just a little bit of talent and a few things you can do, and it will
that
do
you learned
every
a long time
that you learned
ago.
A long time ago, and you don't have any time to practice, and it's going to bend over backwards to make you able to play a few cool things. And in the process of doing that, it rules out a lot of flexibility.
Okay.
If I were to write a song on a piece of paper and come over here, I probably couldn't play it because this is designed to make me look like I know what I'm doing when in fact I'm just playing a stupid beat I learned in the third grade.
Okay. Now, Matt, what do you guys – I mean – Chris was talking about the different ways of attacking, you know, the soft mallet, hard mallet.
Yeah.
You guys aren't using mallets at all.
No. As a matter of fact, this is a way evolved state of technology that we've, you know, we've got corrugated fiberglass with fiberglass tubes to stiffen it a little bit and closed cell rubber. See how much we learned at Canal Street?
Canal rubber.
But the original mallets that we used for several years, actually.
Even during the run.
Even during the opening of the Astor, was my dad's flip-flops, literally.
Right.
Flip-flops that I went into the closet, got them, we taped up the heels, and we played them, and they just have, you know,
right,
the exact right kind of. Now, after a certain amount of time, they started to disintegrate, and then we started saying, "Hey, if we play harder, you know, you it'll be a little louder. You have more of a dancer-like quality." But then the flip-flops disintegrated faster, so then we had to evolve the whole thing. And
so you've got these.
This is actually generations, literally, like.
So this is paddle version 5.0 or something
like that.
I'd say
25.0, actually.
But we have been accused by the magazine Flip Flop Monthly for selling out.
Yes.
And it's hard to defend. I mean, I think they're right.
Oh, gosh. We're on location with Matt Goldman and Chris Wink, two of the three founders, along with Phil Stanton of the Blue Man Group. We're on location for this segment of Soundcheck. Now, you guys started, you know, innocently enough, here in the East Village. But that was long ago. Now you guys are franchised. I mean, you've got Blue Man shows. The Blue Man Group is in cities around the country. It's in Berlin. You've just come back from Vegas.
Yeah.
Where the Blue Man Group has opened at the Venetian.
That's right.
Yeah.
So this show was built around the very specific talents of the three of you.
Right, which is pretty funny to make other people have to play instruments that were designed around our needs, but it still works out pretty good. It's been kind of fun passing it on to other people and letting them play in our playground, and I think they enjoy it. The kind of people we attract to be performers in the show generally are people with a drummer background. Some of them have left it behind and studied acting and so on, which is also an important skill. But this is the ultimate playground for a drummer. I mean, mm-hmm. You get to move from percussion instrument to percussion instrument. So it's not so much that it's designed, you know, I was sort of joking a little bit, to our specific idiosyncrasies. It's designed for drummers.
So most of them can come up to this set of PVC pipes
and
do
play
the little
something.
Pattern.
Yes, they could do, almost anyone could do that instantly. Because, see, for us, one of the things, we mentioned punk rock, and it might be interesting for someone listening to the show thinking, well, I don't know, I don't get any punk rock from the show. First of all, the Blue Man's very sweet overall, you know, and there's a good vibe, and it's kind of a mixture of like a hippie vibe. But what we mean by punk rock is just this sort of the idea of expressing an emotion being more important than technical virtuosity. Mm-hmm. So when we're on stage and the Blue Man's playing, it's not about showing you how difficult the part is, or, you know, it's not a virtuoso performance that, you know, it's not going to see Yo-Yo Ma up,
right,
at, you know, and that's a great thing. It's just that's not what this is about. People really understand when they're watching that, especially since the Blue Man doesn't speak, that he's expressing himself in this moment of playing, and that there's actually something happening in the interior life during the song. You know, we ask the audience to suspend their disbelief, almost as if the song's being written mm-hmm. in real time based on how the Blue Man feels. And so if it was a really complicated microtonal song of some kind, you wouldn't believe that at all. You would be noticing and thinking, wow, how long do they practice that?
Right.
That's always been part of our juxtaposition. We want you to see a character that seems unusual, see a space, go into a theater that's unusual, but then have a human connection. We don't want to be like robots or something ultimately weird. And, you know, we could have easily chosen musical models like Parch or some of these, you know, microtonal, really experimental things. We could have said, well, hey, the Blue Man looks strange. Why don't we play music that sounds strange? And instead, we went the other way because we want you to maybe almost prejudge the character at first, say he's different, and then realize throughout the course of the show that you actually were prejudiced and that he's extremely human. He just doesn't talk the way we talk, doesn't operate the way we talk. He sees things with fresh eyes through perhaps mainly the music and through the character's eyes and some of the behavior and the way he treats the audience with respect and with a desire to connect. You see that there's a lot of human emotion in there. It's not Devo. It's not robots. It's not an alien. It's actually very human, and that guides most of our musical choices, to have a very kind of populist, simple music that maybe even crosses taste lines.
Does that sort of determine your choice of songs to cover on the rare occasions when you have covered other people's songs? I mean, for many years, White Rabbit by Jefferson Airplane was an important part of the show.
Yeah.
Right.
And now on one of the CDs, you do a version of Donna Summer's I Feel Love.
Well, the covers are a different thing. They're more, they're slightly comedic and pop cultural references, and it's important that they're recognizable. And, you know, we've done anything from, in the old days, we did, you know, TV theme show songs like Bonanza or whatever. We wanted it to be a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek moment, just to see the Blue Man innocently hitting these songs like a Virgin or Whip It or, you know, Crazy Train or Free Bird. You know, these are, a lot of these are older references. But what's interesting is that more recently, culture has become more subdivided. And it's hard to find a song that everybody knows in the audience. And if you did find that song, it'd be hard to play on the PVC because it'd probably have to be like Eminem or something.
Right. You did this version of Donna Summer's I Feel Love, and let's hear a little bit from the Blue Man Group. Listening to an encore broadcast of Soundcheck. It first aired in November of this year. We'll continue this conversation with the Blue Man Group after a brief break. You're listening to Soundcheck. Today's Soundcheck program is a rebroadcast that originally aired on November 25th. For more information about today's program or to send us email, visit our website at wnyc.org. Chris Wink and Matt Goldman are two of the three founders of the Blue Man Group, along with Phil Stanton. We are, for this edition of Soundcheck, in their performance studio / rehearsal space with all of these instruments that you guys have developed and worked with over the years. Matt, Chris was talking before about, you know, how this isn't really about virtuosity.
Right.
But there certainly is virtuosity involved in being a Blue Man.
Right. Well, you know, if you paint yourself bald and blue and you build a few instruments that are unique to yourself, you're absolutely guaranteed to be one of the top three musicians in your field. So I guess in that regard, virtuosity to the highest level, right? The virtuosity, it's a different kind of virtuosity because I performed on a regular basis for years and years in front of audiences, and there were definitely people in the audience who could play musical instruments better than I could. So the type of virtuosity was sort of in your passion,
right,
and in your wanting to do something unique.
But there's
and special.
Also the kind of the physical. The activities that the Blue Man has to engage in on stage.
One of the hardest things to do in the show is hitting the big drum. I think the audience probably doesn't think too much about it. in terms of how hard it might be, because after about 10 hits, you're already exhausted.
Mm. But I'm not even talking about musical virtue. I'm talking about, like, you got to be able to catch all those marshmallows yes. in your mouth and stuff. I mean, that's virtuosic. I mean, somebody's standing 15 feet away from you, he's got to have a good arm, got to yeah. have good aim, and then you've got to be able to catch the stuff.
It is something. You might be the first person to call it virtuosity. and it's certainly not a very transferable skill to anything beyond this. But, yeah, you do have to be able to catch things in your mouth, and that's something.
Is that in the job description?
Oh, yeah. That's part of the audition. If there's anybody listening who is interested in becoming a blue man that has acting, drumming, and catching-in-mouth skills, but either male or female, we would be happy to meet with them.
All right. Now, are there any blue women?
There have been at various stages, and we are always trying to have more. I suppose our height requirement is a little bit biased. It's like a 5'9 height requirement, but it biases everyone who's under 5'9. We're definitely looking to cast anybody who has the right skills.
We are on location with two of the three founders of the Blue Man Group, Chris Swink and Matt Goldman. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck. Now, Matt, you guys have made this move from the East Village via Alice Tully to Astor Place, theaters around the country, Berlin, the Venetian in Vegas. It seems like within the last couple of years, Blue Man Group has done something that you've been building up to the whole time, and that is go out and do a rock tour. I mean, is this basically, has this whole thing been, a thinly disguised attempt to become rock stars?
Yes, you got us. It's true. I guess we're big fans of Spinal Tap. I mean, who isn't? Mm-hmm. We have a love-hate relationship with rock and roll. There's a reason why we're not still trying to be in a rock band, because, for many reasons. But there's a part of us that has always, wanted to do that. Of course, the rock tour was, it was a great situation to get to the point where we said, hey, why don't we try to do this rock tour? Because it was actually kind of crazy, even still, because we don't have any hit songs, and we don't have the charismatic lead singer that everyone recognizes, and all these kinds of things. But we set about doing a rock show, but with a little bit of tongue-in-cheek. It was, we wanted it to be some kind of ratio of fake rock show and real rock show. Kind of similar to the approach we had with performance art when we first started. We were sort of saying, hey, performance art, let's just catch a bunch of crap in our mouth and then say $4,000, kind of make fun of the whole thing. But then as the show went on, you sort of thought, hey, wait a minute. They kind of tricked me, because I think a couple of moments there were actually performance art. Yeah. And we want to do the same thing. The rock concert, the conceit is the Blue Men have found a manual and that has templatized how to do a rock concert. And the idea being that it's now an old art form as opposed to a new and cutting edge one. So that there's actually a manual that just tells you how to do it. And so we can play a little bit around with we can make a little fun of things. And the idea then is that as an audience, we're going to templatize our audience reactions. We're even going to tell them when to do the arm fist pump.
Right.
We don't need, we're not going to wait for the idea of spontaneous eruption, especially since there's no hit songs or whatever. We're going to actually just ask them to do it on certain cues. And so the Blue Man will be playing rock star and the audience will be playing rock audience, because we're all too jaded to actually have a genuine, no one screams like to the Beatles anymore. Now we could barely even want to stand up, at a concert, So the funny thing is that hopefully our attempt is by the end, or maybe even by the middle, you realize that we've snuck an actual rock moment in, and you had an actual rock time for a moment. Yeah. You got excited. You really did cheer along. And then we sort of vacillate back and forth, and we get to play around with some of these instruments, like the piano smasher that we couldn't fit into our theaters for whatever reason, or didn't fit into with different songs, and the cymbalum, and a few things that gave us a chance to show some of these instruments that have been around. We've recorded with them, but we hadn't been able to parade them in front of people.
Well, the piano smasher, if this is the contraption we're standing in front of now, looks like a baby grand piano on its side, mounted onto a big metal table.
Yeah, well, this is actually just one part.
It does look a lot like that, doesn't it? It looks a lot like that.
It looks exactly like that, except for the fact that there's no lid on the piano and most of the strings are missing. So what is this?
Usually, there's four pianos. For example, on the album, there's a song called Piano Smasher. And
On the complex.
It took four of these to do it because what we've done is it's one note per piano. We take off all the high strings, we leave the low ones on, and we basically tune them, we kind of reverse it so that some of the low ones go where the high ones would be and the high ones go where the low ones would be. So it evens it out, and they all go to one note. And then you get a giant mallet, and you smack the piano. It doesn't really matter where you hit it, as long as you sort of hit some of the strings. And then all the strings resonate together. There's slight differences in tuning, and even if you try to tune it, you'll get a slight phasing. You get a long sustain. For the Piano Smasher song, we had to use four pianos. Any piano lover would probably cringe seeing us, you know, hitting it with a giant mallet with all our might.
Although I do want to say that almost every piano that we've used was going to the piano graveyard.
Yes.
And we saved it and gave it a second life, not...
It's sort of an adopt-a-piano program.
Very good. All right, I'm going to back up if you're going to hit this.
I'll just give it a whack. This isn't really... this is just sort of an idea of what... And I'll give you another one real quick. Now I hit it. We purposely like it when the strings kind of hit each other and you get that. A higher version of it would be. But you get that attack. You know, what the interesting thing about a piano is that you've got these cool strings, but they're struck by these delicate little, you know, kind of...
Hammers, yeah.
These little... Well, yes, hammer's an interesting term. I wouldn't call it a hammer. I would call it a little padded finger. And what we want is to get a real hammer.
A real hammer,
and
okay.
Yes, I wouldn't... I think that's a real misnomer. Those aren't hammers. Those are little delicate upper-class finger pads.
So, Matt, is that piece, Piano Smasher, that's part of the... The tour, the actual tour.
We tour with these huge pianos. They get their own truck. They get their own bus. It's a little expensive.
They have their own dressing room.
Yeah, it's terrible. But it's worth it because it's, you know, such a cool, unique sound. And it shows up on quite a few pieces. And it's also very, very dramatic and very theatrical. And the Blue Man has this huge mallet and, you know, almost swings like a baseball bat. And
so there are four of these Piano Smashers in the song called Piano Smasher. Let's hear a little bit of that from the Blue Man Group record called The Complex. And while we're listening to that, maybe we can move over to the Cymbalum and we'll hear some of that next. You're listening to Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and we're doing our show today from the East Village Rehearsal Studio of the Blue Man Group, and speaking with two of the three founding members of the group, Chris Wink and Matt Goldman. The instrument that we are standing in front of now, this is a genuine instrument, clearly not manufactured by any of you.
Yes.
This is a cymbalum. It's like a Hungarian zither.
Well, it's in the... dulcimer family.
Right, right.
It's like a hammer dulcimer. What we know of it, what we think we know anyway, is that it was a kind of an Eastern European instrument. It was sometimes called a poor man's piano. It could load up into a wagon, a horse-drawn mm-hmm. wagon, easier than a piano could. It's often played with padded mallets and could sound like a piano. It has a it goes from low to high like a piano, but it's just basically, it's similar to the piano's measure in that it's just a bunch of strings on a table. What attracted us to it was the idea, we didn't need to modify it at all, but we'd play it with regular hard drumsticks as opposed to, again, those soft mallets, so that you get the attack. If you were to hit this with a soft mallet, it would sound pretty much exactly like a piano. But if you hit it with sticks, you get a little bit of a growl. You get a little bit of attack, but then this sort of growl builds. And I can't think of a better term than growl, but I'll give you an example here, just of some random hitting here. It's that one's out of tune. You can see it's but there's a kind of a, especially down these low notes. Let me hit another low note. So we can, as drummers, work the accents a little more than you could on piano. You can get some alternate sticking. The strings start to vibrate against each other. You get some kind of noise to it.
Yeah.
So I'll play a little more. That's kind of out of tune, but that's the idea. Now, it has the high part, which really is exactly like a dulcimer. Just the higher, thinner strings, they're unwrapped. This gets you into a whole different vibe. They have this bridge down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you hit one side of the string, you get that note. Hit the other side.
That's the same set of strings.
Same set of strings, but they've been bridged so that right. This one's, what is that, a fifth above, I would say?
Yeah.
And so that's a nice harmonic thing. And so you start to, and what we do, again, it's not chromatic. We start to pick random notes and see if we can find a favorable placement for a typical drummer. And you get stuff like. That could be the theme song to this show.
You know, that sounds like you can actually play this instrument.
As you can see, I'm just doing a very simple pattern, and it's because the instruments are, those notes are placed, it's all an illusion.
One other important thing to note is we say we haven't really altered it in any way, except I think in one important way, we've put pickups all over it on the soundboard. This particular one has all the pickups stuck underneath, but mm-hmm. different versions, depending on the songs and where we're using it, has guitar pickups and bass pickups. And so we've taken an acoustic instrument and made it electric.
Let me see if I can do a... All right, so for example, if you wanted to use this instrument mm-hmm. to create the theme song for Soundcheck...
Okay.
You could get two completely different kind of musical vibes.
I'm not paying you for this,
okay,
by the way.
So here, you can use these. So here's for the first one. It would be welcome to Soundcheck. Today's guests are Matt Goldman and Chris Swink from Blue Man Group. Or you could go with
welcome to Soundcheck. Today we're with the Blue Man Group. Soundcheck.
Soundcheck. Soundcheck.
Soundcheck.
Soundcheck. I'm just, something you can have. You can have that.
Thank you.
You can use that. You can use that.
I'm John Schaefer. My guests are Chris Wink and Matt Goldman, two of the founders, along with Phil Stanton of the Blue Man Group. Now, this instrument, the dulcimer, the cymbalum, to give it its real name, I mean, this is not just in the tour. This actually has been a kind of a key part of the shows from very early on.
Yes, we recorded with it. It doesn't fit into every one of our theaters, but it fits in Las Vegas. You know, one of the reasons, there were several, but that we were attracted to this facility in Las Vegas.
Was the Venetian?
And originally, when we first went there, just the we could use all of our instruments because there's so much room. It literally couldn't fit into the Astor Place Theater. So we were able to use our larger, thicker tubulum instrument there, and we got the cymbalum into the band loft.
When you see that, when you see finally being in a space big enough to use all the instruments, do the three of you sort of look at each other and go, I wish we were the ones who were out there playing them?
Yeah, it is. It's true. But it's just satisfying seeing him up there. And especially, another instrument that we couldn't get into the small theaters were some of the air pole instruments that are...
You should probably explain what those are.
Well, they're just boat antennas that you just slice to the air, but you have to have a little bit of space because if you smack the person next to you or one of the audience members, it's not going to be a pretty situation.
Yeah.
And we have worked it into the smaller shows now, but originally we couldn't figure out how, especially the Angel pole.
These are fiberglass poles. They range from 6 to 10 feet, and depending on the diameter and the stiffness depends on how quickly you can have the thing
and
go
whip
up
it
and
through
down.
The air.
You whip it through the air, a little mic at the end, and you get this whoosh type of sound. Or
we've got a couple over there we could show you if you want.
All right.
We did open the Vegas show.
Oh, so the three of you got back into the blue.
Back in the first Vegas run a couple of years ago, and we came up with this for the first time, and we're like, wow, one of the blue men can just do this for 3 minutes straight to open the show. Who's going to do it? And Phil and Chris looked at me, and they go, well, you play the big drum, you play the Angel pole. And so
there's a couple of things to say. One of our principles is that we think of the ratio of effort to how much sound and how much variety of sound you can get. And most instruments are designed like a flute or a guitar that with a certain amount of training, you could play any note and get a lot of chords, a lot of variety. We like to have a really bad ratio. For example, this air pole, this angel pole, only makes one sound at one tempo, and it takes an enormous amount of work. Now, what's good about that, though, is that when you go see the performer do it, they're really doing something. And I'm sort of kidding, but I'm sort of serious. There's another instrument which we should talk about called the trombone, which takes three people, and with all of these massive movements, it can only play four notes, at least in tune. It can play an infinite number of out-of-tune increments in between those four notes. But it's like a trombone for drummers. And
combining all the worst aspects of both.
And all the worst aspects of both. Right. And but what it is, though, is in all genuineness, is a symbol of our collaborative process. We work together, and the Blue Men work together to create... for lack of a better term, a gestalt, a whole that's greater than the sum of the parts. And the trombone is an example of, alone, those instruments are nothing. They're just pieces of two. But when the three get together, they actually make a simple but nonetheless melodic song. And that piece means a lot to us because it's kind of a symbol for what we think has gotten us here. We think that we got here because of our collaboration as opposed to any individual inspiration. Mm. We inspire each other and we work hard together, and now as a community we all do that. And that's really what gets us up in the morning is that belief.
So you and Matt are going to show us two simple instruments played together,
Matt,
and I'm backing way out of the way here.
Matt has an angel pole and his sounds like this. Now, I have an angel pole, and mine sounds like this. Hold on. They sound exactly the same.
They do.
let's see what it sounds like together.
You're doing that thing with your mouth. All Angel Paul players do that thing with their mouth. You see it?
Wait, they're kind of gritting their jaw or whatever.
Ugh. But you can see the moment when we finally get in together.
Yeah.
And then there's an interesting thing that happens when we get out. Well, I don't know if it's interesting exactly.
Just kind of in closing, let me ask the two of you, how much, I mean, you've talked about what Blue Man meant, you know, the sort of the everyman character, you know, the communal, the tribal aspect of a lot of what you do, which really comes out in the shows. How much of that was intended at the beginning, and how much of that has just kind of evolved over the years? Has it been a tale that's grown in the telling?
Oh, absolutely. I think the character evolved over a number of years, even after we'd opened the show. What was interesting is when we had to start teaching other people to do it, it forced us to make some choices of how to articulate things, and as opposed to just sort of doing whatever we felt like at any given moment. We've learned a lot from the character, you know, and from this kind of mask work. I think that mask work, I think to some degree we're part of that tradition, is very profound, because you put on a mask, and in so doing you take off your mask, your cultural mask, and that's very liberating. And I think that there was an aspect of liberation that we felt when we got into the character that we couldn't have predicted, and that led us and informed some of our creative choices as to how to perhaps give the audience a taste of that liberation. So we've talked about the strobe lights and the paper at the end, but in a sense, that was an attempt to give the audience a taste of what it's like to be the Blue Man and not feel self-conscious, not feel like, you know, what am I wearing today at work that makes me fit in and make people not judge me or think I'm a jerk. And also the element of how important it is to be an ensemble player, to not go off on your own, whether it be in a song or in, you know, just some of the interaction on stage. I think anybody who works in the arts, the lively arts, that, you know, from improv to music, is exposed to profound life wisdom, because you are learning things that go counter to a lot of the ego, achievement-driven culture at what you're getting on television. And so we have grown to appreciate the importance of all the arts in becoming a happy, adjusted adult, and get horrified when we hear
now,
about...
Are you talking about yourself or Blue Man as a happy, adjusted adult?
Yes, I don't know. I just think that television and the culture doesn't necessarily give you all the things that you would need, and many things that would help you in life are counterintuitive, such as the value of being part of a collective as opposed to just drawing attention to yourself, the value of listening over... speaking, yeah. For example, and
since there is no speech at all, has Blue Man ever said anything?
Well, the Blue Man that we know today has never said anything. Early on in some of the experiments, there was some language, but we very quickly realized that the character really didn't show up until we shut up.
We keep learning more and more about who the character is and what he's all about, and interestingly, we often learn it from people who have nothing to do with the project, you know, even first-time watchers, you know, they'll say something like, you know, I liked all this, that, and the other, but you know that one thing? I don't think the Blue Man would ever really do that. And that's always such a shocking statement. We've been hearing that versions of that since the very beginning, and to think that there's almost like this collective consciousness or this thing that is so intangible and amorphic, you know, that you can never put your hands on, but that someone who's never seen it before would say the Blue Man would not do something, you know, or that's out of character for the Blue Man. That's a very humbling type of experience that just has you keep searching for what it is that the Blue Men do. And at the same time, I think in the last, you know, you had mentioned in the last couple of years that the rock tour and some other things that we've done, I think the Blue Man has expanded his horizons far beyond anything that we would have pictured just, you know, a few months prior to that piece of work going out. So we're constantly being wonderfully surprised and by all these different attributes and things that the Blue Man does.
All right, so the Blue Man Group, the Rock Tour, June through December of 2006. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, people who want to be handed a half-eaten bowl of Cap'n Crunch and then be covered in toilet paper can see the show, which continues to run at its ancestral home here in the East Village, a couple blocks away from this space where we're speaking with both Chris Wink and Matt Goldman, two of the founders of the Blue Man Group. The Astor Place Theater still running. It's basically every night, right?
Literally every night.
Phil Stanton is the third founding member of the Blue Man Group, but to the two of you, Chris, Matt, thank you so much for walking us through your space and taking some time with us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks, fun for us.
This is Soundcheck. That'll do it for today's show. Tomorrow on Soundcheck, science says that mice have just joined a select group of animals known to be singers. So what is singing? We'll explore the scientific and the musical definitions. Also, speaking of singing, we'll have a reassessment of Puccini, the most popular opera composer, and a conversation with composer Steve Reich. Soundcheck's technical director is Irene Trudell. The program is produced by Allison Lichter and Brian Wise, with help today from Eileen Delahunty. Our senior producer is Gisele Regatau. Our executive producer is Chris Bannon. I'm John Schaefer. Join us again at this time tomorrow for another Soundcheck here on New York Public Radio. Thanks for listening to today's podcast of Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.